Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, hit subscribe, and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. Also, I'm so hurt that I'm late today because I was watching, it was Thursday night, where we had a pre-recorded show, and someone asked a question in the chat, is this pre-recorded? And they said, and there was a response, of course it is, because they're on time. So, I took a little offense to that. So, I had a goal to be on time today, and I still missed it. But, we are here. I would love to send a massive shout out to all the subscribers on YouTube and Twitch and all the other audio only platforms, and much love to the patrons. You keep TIR independent and going, so if you have the means and feel so inclined, become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. You can have access to champagne rooms past and present. You can be in the live studio audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour, and you can join us for movie nights. And we're going to be having another movie night very, very soon. And tonight, after the show, we're going right into the patron call-in segment. Sound off. I know there is so much going on in this internet podcast universe that you probably want to yell at me about. Will I listen? I don't know. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. But now that we got that out of the way, let's get to the good stuff. You know, why you guys are here in the first place. We're going to talk about malls, Fordism, socialism. While many of our younger viewers may not have nostalgia for mass consumption and air-conditioned shopping paradises, for those of us Gen Xers, the shopping mall was the last communal space. I met my first wife in a shopping mall, true story, and made lifelong friends at the mall as well. Nothing speaks to the Cold War nostalgia of American greatness quite like waxing poetic about these iconic shopping spaces. Malls were at a time so popular, music recording artists broke out into the mainstream via mall tours. Remember the 80s pop sensation Tiffany? But besides being a bastion of middle-class suburban teenage angst and independence, what was the modern shopping mall truly meant to be in the heart of one of its early creators? What did the mall accomplish in helping to destroy the more common, at the time of its inception, downtown shopping areas, urban areas that were filled with actual public spaces, not privatized convenience? Today, we bring in writer and recent columnist for Sublation magazine, Patrick Roussel. In an article for Sublation titled Malls, Fordism, and Socialism, Patrick writes, "But it's true, the mall was once new, ambitious, iconoclastic, even. Superstar architects and designers were interested in making them. Influential critics in magazines like The New Yorker and Architectural Forum gushed over them. Women's Wear Daily columnist Samuel Feinberg was so impressed by the ultra-modern regional shopping centers of the late 1950s that he deliberately echoed the famous pronouncement of muckraker journalist Lincoln Stevens upon his return from the fledgling Soviet Union. I have seen the future, and it works. Some of this enthusiasm must be understood in the context of not only 1950s prosperity, but of the political, economic, and ideological complement to the United States' post-war golden age, the ascendant consumer economy fueled by the mass production and consumption of luxury goods, stood for an elaborate, integrated ideal of economic abundance and democratic political freedom, both equitably distributed, that became almost a national civil religion from the late 1940s into the 70s, writes Elizabeth Cohen in her epochal, A Consumer's Republic. The ideal provided the blueprint for American economic, social, and political maturation, as well as for export around the globe. Cohen notes that this particular strategy of guaranteeing and flouting American greatness had the Cold War era appeal of putting money in people's pockets by increasing the size of their economic pie without the socialistic resizing of any class slice. And for a while, it seemed to work. If the consumer economy was a civil religion, then the modern shopping mall was its cathedral. Again, that is from a piece in Sublation magazine, Malls, Fordism, Socialism. Please welcome author Patrick Wessel.
Hello.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And you're in the East Coast.
Yes, I'm in Philly. I grew up in North Jersey.
Oh, that's kind of mall heaven.
Yeah, I was within maybe 30 minutes distance from, there was the Rockaway Town Square, which was the one that I frequented. There was the Livingston Mall. There was the Willowbrook Mall. There was the ultra bougie Short Hills Mall, which I didn't go to. There was the kind of crappy Ledgewood Mall that was one story, didn't have a fountain, but also was the place where the kids went to play Magic the Gathering. So I spent a bunch of my time in middle school there.
Okay.
But the place I came up with was very suburban and very mollified.
Now, what was kind of the impetus for you to want to write about this? Because as Sublation columnists, they don't give us assignments.
Right. I read, there was a book that was released in 2022, Alexandra Lang's Meet Me by the Fountain. It ran the circuit of all like the usual like sites in the liberal chatosphere. Mm-hmm. And I was, I was a mall rat growing up. I worked at malls for years. Mm-hmm. And I picked up the book and I read it, and there was a lot that I enjoyed, but it got a little bit stuck in my craw.
Was it too nostalgic for you?
Nostalgia I can deal with. I was actually rereading chunks of it in preparation for this, and it's funny because I wrote the article just to sort of like get salt out of my system out of reading the book. And now I'm like wondering like wherefore salt? Why did it get under my skin the way it did? And I think on the one hand, I don't even want to say it's unalloyed nostalgia, because she rattles off this whole list of problems with the mall historically. Like early on in the book, she just runs down this itemized list, built on colonized land, often built on wetlands, contributed to white flight from the cities and urban blight, helped to lock in the middle class whiteness of the American suburbs. But then she turns around and says, and basically talks about, it's just malls are so much fun. It's great to go to a mall with your friends and your kids and get Starbies and shop for apparel. And she says, I'm basically quoting, that you go to malls to shop for your true selves. It's a little bit too more of an apology, it's more apologetic of the mall than makes me comfortable. But at the same time, I think what really, rereading it, what really got stuck in my craw was the fact that she's, in a way, she's a realist. I can't decide whether she's a realist or if she's lacks imagination, but she, when she says something to the effect that like people who are dancing on the graves of dead malls are failing to acknowledge the alternatives, She's right. These things, the suburbs were built around these things, and there's not much else in the way of community spaces except for shopping spaces that really work in the context of the suburbs.
Well, let's actually talk about the early days of suburbs. I think people, depending on the history that you know about maybe places like Levittown, suburbs were, and you mentioned this in your piece as well, created in the kind of the hinterlands. Or, one of the reasons we had so much post-World War II growth was we had all this open space. So as all these suburbs are being built, people still have to travel very far to get into the urban core to, shop. And so when these malls are created, some people are creating them with a little bit more in mind of community space, especially someone that I do want to talk about in this episode, Victor Gruen, who comes from, I believe it's Austria, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
and is a socialist and has a different vision of a mall where it's like there's a hospital and there's schools. And, you know, for those that don't know, a big part of the pushback on public housing, which has kind of always been talked about and thrown around in the early days, even before World War II, in places like Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles, one of the pushbacks was it was too socialistic or communistic to have these wonderful places. And then also real estate barons didn't really want to make public housing in the U.S. context anything like what was happening across the pond. So the mall, in its inception, is kind of a modern marvel of architecture. Did you want to kind of talk about that?
I'm not even sure where to begin. Well, we can talk about Victor Gruen.
Yeah, let's start.
He was born in 1903 in Austria. He was trained as an architect. He was the director of the Socialist Event Group, a political cabaret in Vienna from 1926 through 1934. Was a big admirer of, I'm just going to mispronounce his name, Joseph Popper Lynckeus, who was a late 19th century, early 20th century thinker who more or less predicted the modern welfare state or called for something like it. Mm-hmm. He fled the Nazis in 1938 and lived in New York. His first job, or one of his first jobs, was working to design Bell Geddes' Futurama exhibition that was he was contracted to build for GM. So Gruen, who was a man who later in life just despised the automobile and what it did to urban design, was the for one of his earliest jobs in the United States was he helped to design this exhibition that basically called for a giant freeway system that would crisscross the country and make it so that GM would never have to worry about selling cars ever again. And at the time it was a marvel. Giant freeways, overpasses, underpasses, cloverleaf patterns, nothing that existed at the time. Gruen said that no one working on it really anticipated this ever really happening. He just knew that he was being paid $50 a week to do it as a very recent emigre to the United States. But from there, he got some jobs in Manhattan designing stores and storefronts for like candy shops and leather goods stores, made a name for himself, designed some department stores on the West Coast, and then moved to LA and hated LA. He called it a non-city because its reliance, even in the early 30s and 40s, its reliance on the automobile, it was being designed around automobile use. He said that anything like urbanity was impossible.
Well, LA is the modern city, right? We have to remember that that is, you know, for those that haven't read Mike Davis, there's also other good books about the interstate system, but Los Angeles is not like New York in that regard, where New York is kind of, at least the city, is built around public transportation. Los Angeles is definitely built around urban sprawl and needing an automobile to get around the vastness of Los Angeles County.
So to go ahead with Gruen's story, he continued to design department stores on the West Coast, and he did a lot of flying around the country. And in the late 1940s, I forget exactly what year it was, there was a snowstorm and it brought down his plane in Detroit. And he was stuck there for a while, so he got a colleague's family member to give him a tour of the town. And he was not a fan of Detroit. He talked about it being desolate and run down, with the one exception of the Hudson's department store in the middle of the city, which was owned by a fellow named Oscar Weber at that point. It was just this beacon of prosperity and modernity among just this ramshackle industrial town, and it left a big impression on him. And when he was telling the person who was showing him around, like he is giving him his candid opinion on downtown Detroit, saying he didn't like it, his friend said, "Oh, no. Yeah, nothing happens downtown. Like, all life is in the suburbs." And so the next day he took him to the suburbs, and I'm just going to read to you his description of the outlying areas around Detroit. Mm-hmm. This is from Victor Gruen's autobiography, posthumously published. The rest of the outlying area that was not covered by industry resembled a patchwork quilt. It was composed of small lots of land with small yards and medium-sized lots with medium yards. On each plot sat a boxy house with a completely useless piece of lawn. This yard was the calling card of the home's inhabitants, and it was constantly edited with a lawnmower. On the road-facing sides of the houses were rarely used living rooms with oversized windows, called picture windows. In passing, it seemed to me that through each of these windows I saw the same floor lamp with plastic shade, the same vase, the same flowers, and the same table. This was what lay between the main roads. The main roads themselves were zoned exclusively for business. Here a motley collection of large and small companies had settled, a garishly advertised parade of filling stations, hot dog stands, department stores, snack bars, liquor stores, supermarkets, chain stores, used car lots, and funeral parlors. Most of these enterprises were housed in buildings of only one story and were dependent on roadside parking. In exceptional cases, parking spaces were provided in front of or behind a row of buildings, in which case the block then proudly called itself a mall. Included were three large department stores, all branch locations of national companies. Although these main streets were extraordinarily wide, they could not accommodate the combined burdens of shopping traffic, parking, the delivery and shipping of goods, and pedestrian needs. To escape the endless traffic jams, one had to park on the residential streets. The generously planned major road network had become unusable. In a city where there was no notable public transportation system, an ambitious urban motorway network had ruthlessly torn the residential areas into pieces. Mm. Everyone concerned cursed the roads, and there were numerous protest movements against them. But when confronted with the argument that without motorways they could not reach their jobs in the auto industry, the protesters capitulated. So,
really? Wow.
So Gruen saw this problem of urban decay, and he saw this problem of suburban sprawl. Mm. Between looking at these pell-mell unplanned suburbs and looking at the Hudson's department store in the middle of Detroit, this beacon of civilization among all of this desolation, he's inspired. He'd written before in an architectural forum, I believe it was architectural forum in the 1943, they had this issue about like what, you know, America of the future. And he described, well, even back then, he called it a mall, as in a large promenade. It would have been this pedestrian-only space with just with a central department store, and walkways with stores that didn't face the streets but faced inward. And there would be benches, places to sit down, gardens, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time, it got a lot of attention. And he went to the head of the Hudson's department store company, this fellow named Oscar Weber, and pitched him this idea, like, you need to branch out into the suburbs, and you need to, and he basically appealed to this man's sense of civic responsibility. He said, the suburbs are a wreck, it needs order and planning, and as a pillar of the business community of Detroit, it's, you know, the onus is on you to do this. And Weber said, yeah, okay, let's do this. And what I ended up doing was building the Proto Shopping Mall. It was the Northland Shopping Center in Southfield, Michigan, and it was open for business in 1956. And it was basically a shopping mall, except that it was outdoors. The Hudson's Department Store was in the center of this thing, and you had walkways and inwards facing shops, and all of the parking was abutted it. So you could get out of your car and walk around this place. And at the time, it was a sensation. Journalists, it was a site of pilgrimage for journalists. All of the architectural magazines gushed about it. Eleanor Roosevelt toured it and wrote a glowing review of it. And so that wasn't the first shopping mall proper. That was the Northland Center in Southfield, Michigan. That opened up in, that was Edina, Minnesota. It was 1956. Mm-hmm. And it was the anchor for that store. That one was driven by Weber's friend and colleague who owned the Dayton department store, which incidentally, the Hudson's in Dayton, after, you know, decades of acquisitions and mergers, ended up joining together and becoming Target in 2000. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
That's yeah. Nice. So the original malls were underwritten by the companies that would later on become Target.
Big box stores that kind of ended up not right. killing them all, but changing the way suburban shopping.
Right. Functions. The history of the mall and suburbanization is just a history of just cannibalizing.
It's interesting that you say that, because there's one point that I do want to get to that you mentioned a second ago, and that is the fact that Victor Gruen was real big about planning, central planning.
Yes, I was going to
okay.
Get
I'm
that.
Sorry. I'm sorry that I sped you.
No.
But I think that's an important factor, because the pushback that he got from Senator Joseph McCarthy, as you write about, is the planning aspect, because, you know, the whole thing is like, this can't be communistic at all.
McCarthy was more, I'm not sure how much McCarthy weighed in on what Gruen was doing. McCarthy was more against public housing, mm-hmm. which there throughout the 30s and 40s, there were these big fights between the National Association of Real Estate Boards and these activists who wanted more public housing. And with the construction of the, ultimately the people who were in favor of singles family zone suburbs that were produced by subsidized private industry won the day. But as far as the malls are concerned, Gruen told Oscar Weber early on that you're going to build the shopping center, and you're also going to buy all of the land around it, and you're going to direct its growth. You're going to have mixed-use residential areas. You're going to have some single-family houses. You're going to have some mid-rise apartments. There's going to be schools. There's going to be hotels. The idea was that the mall was going to be this axis hub of this area that was going to be planned and orderly, and basically be this antidote for the chaos of suburbia. And ultimately, that's not what came to pass. In every case, he wanted the company that owned the mall to guide the use of the land around it. And ultimately, they ended up selling it off piecemeal to private developers who usually just built more single-family housing developments.
Because that was hot at the time.
You know, yeah.
Housing builds are very trendy. So post-World War II is where you get your smaller shotgun houses, you know, a couple bedrooms and a bathroom, a fence, a very small yard, right? You have your own piece of something. By the time we get to the 80s, then you're starting to get the beginnings of what some people might call McMansions in the build out of suburbs, maybe 3-4 bedrooms. Now you have 2-car garages. By the time we get to the 2000s, now we're getting to more gated communities. And now in this moment, we're seeing more lofts built, luxury lofts in urban areas are the hot thing for developers. So development is always trendy with builders. So at the time, single family residences is what it was all about, because the country wanted to get people out of the idea of shared space.
Right. I don't think it, except for some activists, I don't think they were, it was popular during the Depression. It was really, there were a number of factors. Roosevelt, the fact that the New Deal was never, despite of what its critics said, it was never supposed to be, it was never socialistic. Roosevelt's, I believe in 38, 39, said that a nation of homeowners is indomitable. He was mm-hmm. never interested in the idea of socialized housing. He did think that people owning their own land or their own, just a middle class that owned like a financial asset in the form of land was the way to go. And what ended up happening with the public housing movement was really more or less that the Republicans took the House in 1946, I believe. And that was the first nail in the coffin. And the sad thing is, sadly, the final nail in the coffin was Truman wanted to, you know, his efforts to continue to push for public housing. There was a bill that was going to be passed in, I believe, 1949 that would give government assistance to public housing. And the Republicans torpedoed it by saying, okay, by attaching this rider that said, okay, but all public housing constructed with federal funds must be racially integrated. The Democrats were, you know, the party of the New Deal, but they were also the party of the South, and that just wasn't going to fly. And that was the end of that.
So no public housing.
Yeah.
You weren't expecting
I didn't know
that.
You could do that.
I can do a lot of things here. You came, you, when you get on a show like this, you should at least watch one episode because you have no idea what you're in for.
I was nervous enough. I didn't want to make it any worse for myself for knowing exactly what I was dealing with.
No, it's all good. I mean, look, I, even talking about, 40s, eras that neither one of us were alive in, it still makes me nostalgic for the mall that I grew up near. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, and the mall nearest to me was called Hilltop. It doesn't exist anymore. It's finally gone, and there's condos being built there. There was an ice skating rink there when I was a kid. There was two movie theaters there. By the time I became a teenager, there were dollar movie theaters. Playing like older movies, so I definitely have a fondness for the mall, but I think it is important to also set these things that we have a fondness for in their proper historical context, and what do they do to these downtown areas. And for those Gen Xers watching the show that also watch the Netflix series Stranger Things, in their third season, it centers around a newly minted shopping mall. And if you guys remember, there were protests around the building of the mall. Can you tell us a little bit about what the mall then did to urban downtown spaces once it's created? Because it does make shopping and walking easier.
It's kind of funny. Victor Gruen created the shopping mall, which, as you know, because suburbanites no longer had to get in their cars and drive to established downtowns to shop anymore, they could go to this place where parking was free and abundant and they could walk around without getting honked at or worrying about feeding the parking meter. Mm-hmm. So downtowns were bled of business, and just it created this sort of death spiral for a lot of established shopping towns, as they were sometimes called. I wrote that Paterson, New Jersey was just destroyed by the Garden State Plaza in nearby Paramus. But Victor Gruen decided, he had a hammer in his hand and the problem of urban blight looked like a nail. He said that what we're going to do in order to save downtowns is bring the malls there. And which usually entailed his plan, he had this sort of standardized plan throughout the 60s, which was you're going to get a bunch of highways that circle this area downtown, and they're all going to empty out into multi-story parking garages, and we're going to cut off five, six, however many blocks from motor traffic, and there, done. People,
talking about the creation of the business loop.
Yeah. There was some cases where this was actually what he proposed, and like what it had. Usually, his whole lifetime was his proposals being watered down. Mm-hmm. So he never got to reinvent a downtown the way he wanted it to. But then he had some modest successes. Like there was the Fulton Street Pedestrian Mall in, I believe, Fresno, California, which opened in probably the mid-60s, which wasn't really just, it wasn't so much of a urban shopping mall, but it was more like what he achieved with the Northland, but it was in an urban milieu. And yeah, it was... Like I said, he had a hammer in his hand, and just every problem looked like a nail, and it just seemed like throughout his life, it just seemed like he got more and more frustrated with people not following, with the developers he aligned with not following through with his plans all the way, to the extent that he wanted them to, with chambers of commerce saying socialized parking garages or city-owned parking garages, that's socialism, and we're not going to stand for it.
Jesus.
Yeah, that was what he wanted to reinvent Fort Worth. And that was a big impediment, was that he called for this belt of elevated highways circling the downtown area, and publicly owned parking garages, and there was kickback against that because, you know, chambers of commerce, private, you know, real estate developers, you know, saw someone trying to drink their milkshake.
Does it feel like in these early days of the, like, trying to build these places out, that there really is an ideological pushback, maybe even to make them work properly? Because the constant that you hear in the early days of housing and, you know, building malls, even schools for some cases, is always the fear of it being too socialist.
That was never a concern with the mall, because Victor Gruen thought that he landed on this perfect combination of, like, commerce plus community. He thought that he could use these malls to build these communal centers, which these sprawling suburbs sorely lacked, and there was benefit in it for private business if they went along with this, if they acted civic-minded and did this right. I don't think there was anyone really complaining about it because, one, there was a desperate need for them in the suburbs in the early mid-1950s, early 1960s. And there was nothing socialistic about the mall. It was utopian, but it was utopian in a, you know, post-war American consumerism as path to public prosperity sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And did you watch Stranger Things?
I did not.
What?
No, I don't really watch a lot of the Netflix series.
How could you not watch Stranger Things, at least?
I guess I don't have an answer.
That's like four seasons of Gen X joy.
I am a Xennial, so maybe I'm too young to really appreciate it.
Maybe. I mean, Stranger Things, definitely.
I've heard good things. I'll watch it someday.
There's some things about it that are somewhat problematic. You know, the way they handle race in this small Indiana town is rather comical on one hand.
I don't know. My wife is still getting on me about never having watched Breaking Bad.
So, oh, I thought you were going to say your wife was getting on you for not having black friends. Because that would have been funny.
I have that white person reflex of wanting to say, like, of course I have black friends, but
don't do it. Yeah, just swallow it and suppress it like you do your anger and all other feelings.
All of them. Joy. Sadness. Hunger.
That one
you can't suppress.
You could say that you have black friends, but then I would have made you name them and call one like it was a game show. Like, call one right now.
I could do that. I mean, the first one that comes to mind, she'd be pissed that I'm calling her out of nowhere at 10 o'clock at night.
That's going to be a new feature on TIR. Going to be when a white person comes on, we're just going to find some reason to say, but do you really know a black person? And then call them up right now. I'm going to see it. I'm going to see you call them. On a video call, because we want to make sure they're really black. No light skin havesies.
Oh, that is a good point.
Can you tell us about how the shopping mall promoted car culture? I guess we kind of touched on that a little bit with the
a little bit
with the Highway Act.
It's interesting. I mean, thinking it over, it was the mollification of America was this concatenation of different processes. Mm-hmm. You had America's rapid motorization due to Fordism. Like, I think it was in by the early 1940s, I think 88% of Americans had, you know, a family car. Whereas I think in 1939, I looked at some stats earlier, it was still like Western Europe's developed nations still had like maybe 21% automobile ownership. And it was mostly an elite, just a toy of the elites at that point. But America was motorized, and that's what made these far-flung dispersed suburbs on the fringes of existing settlements possible. Everyone was expected to have a car. They didn't provide for public transit. You got to where you were going via the car that you left the house that you owned with the car that you owned. And the mall was predicated on, it was basically designed to be this, to fill this this gap between these vast single, like tracts of single use zone suburbs and the burgeoning highway system that connected them all. Mm-hmm. So when malls started, developers started investing in malls on the, you know, edges of existing suburbs, and they got cynical about it real fast. Victor Gruen had idealistic motives. A lot of the developers in the late 50s, early 60s, basically were looking for tax breaks because there was a tax loophole in effect at the time, accelerated depreciation, where you basically just built a big building that made money somehow. The intent was to spur, you know, to catalyze factory growth, but because of the loophole of it could be really just anything that made money, they built, generally it was shopping malls and office plazas. They reaped a whole bunch of free money from these tax loopholes for a few years, sold them off, and then repeated the process elsewhere. And the places where they chose to do this was where land was cheap. So it would just be like some cornfield in, you know, out, like astride a highway. And once that mall appeared, mm-hmm. the cycle of suburban growth continued. They would build malls, you know, they would build roads that, more roads that took people to malls and connected them to existing existing residential areas and new residential areas and new just commercial strips would pop up around the mall. And then as the roads became more unworkable and congested, they would drop another mall somewhere in the vicinity, and it would just repeat itself ad nauseum because of the abundance of land to use. And I'm sorry, I lost my train.
Oh, no, it's okay.
I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. We do have a super chat here. You'd be surprised how many people love the crack. And I do love the crack of a super chat. Can you talk to the future of the mall here in Minnesota? We're staying to see the addition of multifamily anchors, etc. That is from Ken. Ken, thank you so much for the super chat. There's two big malls that I feel to me feel right next to each other. Cause when I was on tour with a kids TV show, I remember going to both of them back to back, and that's the Mall of America. And then in Canada in Edmonton, there's the Mall of, I can't remember the name of it, but it's bigger than the Mall of America. And the Mall of America is just like, it's ridiculously large. It is, and you talk about it in your piece as well. The future of the mall, which is, you know, a question I wanted to end on, Ken. God damn, can you please stop trying to jump ahead? what do you see as the future of the mall? Because one of the things that you did bring up was the fact that as we're building out these suburbs, we're building roads, right? And we're building more malls because we have more people.
Okay, this is the past tense. We're not really building more malls anymore.
Yes, we were. Yeah. I'm speaking in the past tense. And so as all that was being built, right, around these suburban areas, some of that suburban sprawl is gone, and we're seeing suburban, I don't know if there's a name for it yet, but I've seen it written somewhere, I can't remember where, years ago, suburban ghettos, where people have kind of, there's a different kind of flight back into certain urban areas depending on where you live. And what then happens to these shopping centers? They definitely become abandoned. I've seen several abandoned malls throughout America as a touring musician, and it's kind of, I don't want to say, I don't know if there's a right word to say it. It is very kind of, I was in awe the first time I saw an empty mall because it looked like a modern frightening ghost.
Yeah. They're unsettling. I've only been in one. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a ghost mall at that point. It was, the lights were still on. The soda machines were still on and apparently still being stocked, but just all of the stores were, they just like put, you know, covered up all of the entrances of the stores with these white walls. Mm-hmm. And here and there you saw like a mall walker going from the entrance to Walmart to the parking lot. Cause at that point they'd built like a Walmart abutting it that you could enter right from the atrium. It was eerie, but
yeah,
the blighting of suburban areas, that's not new. It was sort of part of the process from the beginning. When Levittown was built, it was a composition of like maybe 50 something or 60 something percent white collar workers, and then a corresponding whatever number of blue collar workers. Mm-hmm. And then they found that about a decade later, a lot of the white collar workers were trading up and going into more affluent suburbs that were popping up here and there. So from the beginning, the suburbanization of America, there was a big sort happening where you went from these suburbs that were originally composed of people from it wasn't altogether economically homogenous, but then it sort of moved in that direction as time passed. As far as the blighting of neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods and shopping areas goes, that's again part of the process. You have a shopping center that was built 20 years ago on a road where people are in the surrounding areas are trying to move out and seek, you know, those who can seek more expensive or like higher end housing do so. Mm-hmm. The rest stay behind. Property values get depressed. People from the surrounding areas stop going on this main drag to like hit up the strip malls and instead go to the sexy new power center a town over, and the area just becomes a backwater.
Yeah.
With the blighting of malls, it's more or less the same. No one wants to live like right next to just a giant, you know, architectural carcass with like trees popping up through the asphalt.
It is a crazy thing to see. And we start this conversation off talking about Detroit, right? And Detroit definitely is a site. I don't know if you've been there in the last 15 years or so, but there's definitely a lot of abandoned buildings, office spaces and shopping malls. But some of the people in Detroit were able to use those spaces to have like urban gardens, things like that. And, you know, there's even repurposed malls where I'm from in Oakland, California, where there's a police station in the old mall in, I guess, a more suburban area of East Oakland, and some other state offices in the mall. I read two things back to back about malls, but I believe it's your piece where you talk about one place, was it Nashville, put a part of their university campus, one of their state university campuses in an abandoned mall. Basically, municipalities trying to, or states trying to repurpose this space,
right?
Which had great parking, usually easy access to get to via car.
There's a lot of enthusiasm for this. I'm not sure. I think it might mostly be among members of the chattering class, because from what I can tell, it's generally cheaper and just generally more effective just to bulldoze the entire thing and start over again. But I understand in some respects share the enthusiasm for repurposing malls and making them into, you know, what they were supposed to be, just dense mixed-use oases in the middle of the suburban sprawl. Mm-hmm. But what gives me pause is something I glanced at when I was rereading Alexandra Lang's book, really just like an hour or so ago. It was about the one of the malls in her home in the town she grew up in Durham, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. The owners of the mall were going to build high multi-level housing in the parking lot, and there was a community push to make some of that affordable housing. And what one of the developers said in response to this, and I quote here, was, "Asking private landowners to solve the city's issues is a misdirected mission." And that's sort of what I keep landing on. When we talk about repurposing malls to revive suburbia or to fulfill Gruen's vision, we're still running into the problem that he did, which is really that just like capitalists gonna capitalist. They're looking out for number one. They're not going to be, if they're going to be twisted, you know, have their arms twisted into civic minded thinking, it's not going to be from activists. It has to be from the government and the state and, you know, just our political economy being what it is right now. I don't foresee that happening anytime soon.
So this is why we always talk about movements on this show, right? You need movements to push the political needle, to push capital's needle, right? So in San Francisco, there is an interesting situation, and I would love to get your opinion on this. And I'm sure you're not following, you know, the intricacies of San Francisco daily politics, but an anchor store in the main mall in downtown San Francisco has decided to leave. Nordstrom is deciding to leave, and several other major companies are leaving. Some of this had to do with the fact that during the shelter in place, leases were up in the city. So there are some that believe that this is a capital strike where these businesses will come back to the city willingly. It's still a great place to live. I was just in the Bay Area this past weekend. But they want to do it on their terms, you know, not the city's terms. And there's all kind of subsidies, as you talked early on, that these builders and developers get when they sign these big leases. And the big question to the mayor of San Francisco, who's quite embattled because of, you know, homelessness and now constant reports about property crime, what are they going to do with a mall if it does become empty? The Nordstrom that was there is about six floors. So you would have like six floors of space.
I mean, right now, all they can do is, I mean, actually, I'm not really that familiar with the situation. I'm not at all familiar with the situation, honestly. Mm-hmm. But with the situation in our politics being what they are, there's really not much to do but plead with private developers to do something with it. I mean, certainly, I don't see the city buying. I mean, maybe they. I don't see the city buying it all up and turning it all into public
affordable
housing.
Yeah, yeah. Affordable housing in California is kind of a nightmare to navigate. For those of you that want to read, there's a great. I think it's like a three or four part series in the LA Times about how there was a hotel that ended up being abandoned somewhere in, I think, San Diego County. And the city had got the land and they were going to use this land to build affordable housing. And a contractor won a bid to get the land. And when it was all said and done, when the plans finally got approved, the developer couldn't break ground because it would have cost $1 million per unit just to build affordable housing. So,
yeah. It's an intractable problem. It's probably going to get worse before it can even begin. There's even the political will to make it better.
And what do you think would turn the needle and make and force there to be a political will? I mean, we are dealing with a houselessness crisis throughout the country, even where you live. You're seeing
that
it
is
as well.
That is the question. I don't think we'll know until it happens.
You know, you're in Philadelphia, you said, correct?
Yes.
And I know during the shelter in place, there was a whole situation about housing unhoused people in hotels. And that was even a big issue. There was an activist right. class that actually eventually made that happen in Philly. And I didn't follow it after they got in the hotels. I don't know if they kept those for unhoused people if it went back to.
Right. A couple of them, they I believe one of the concessions, what they started housing some people who were in that, you know, part of that encampment in. The city would buy apartments in certain neighborhoods and house them there. And the place I lived before this, one of them ended up on my street. I didn't meet them, but I would hear them, you know, walking around the block and screaming at the top of their lungs at 3 a.m. every now and then.
Oh yeah, good times.
Yeah, it's a totally separate kind.
Yeah, but no. Again, I worked. In one of the hotels that we had in Oakland, California. It was a very large hotel and was filled. It was over 300 people. So it was, like I said, good times. But
good times in the US of A.
Yeah, in the, you know, as someone said on another show we had, what a time to be alive. We do have malls that are still thriving, though. And as some people have said in the chat, malls throughout the world are a little different. Asia malls are, I don't want to say respected, but you know, people still frequent them. And in places in Latin America, I live here in Mexico, the mall is always packed out here.
I think it's really hard to compare any other country's situation with the United States. Mm-hmm. They didn't motor. I don't think few other nations motorized as quickly as we did, or built our infrastructure entirely around automobile ownership. And I doubt that they built as many bloody malls as we did. Like I said, like I had 5 malls within half an hour, 40 minutes driving distance of my house.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that from what I have read, the malls are fewer, but they're also much bigger. And in the United States, I understand that it's the larger, more high-end malls that are going to survive this, the ones that give people a reason, that do more than give people just a place to like shop at the Gap or Spencer Gifts. It's the ones that, you know, are, as they say, like, you know, an experience.
Experiential marketing, such an evil thing they did for a short time in my life, making buying things an experience. Gross. But When we think of malls and we think of their place in history, where would you place the mall in history?
I think it's hard. I think of the mall in the United States as this moment in this kind of boneheaded bastard dialectical materialism. Mm-hmm. It was problems were created by motorization and suburbanization, and the cure for it was going to be the mall. And the mall caused its share of problems that had to be resolved and ultimately were resolved by the internet and online shopping. And then that caused its slew of problems. And it almost seems like we're doubling back. I think there's a lot of not just nostalgia for malls. I read this study recently that showed that like people's feelings in general about malls have grown more positive since the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I think people were lonely. You know, the mall was created because there was no place for people to be together or no community hub in the suburbs. And then it became crowded, unwieldy, and just transparently a front for marketing. Gruen, back Gruen and another developer, James Rouse, I think of them. They really truly wanted malls to be civic centers. James Rouse is a developer who pioneered the food court. And the idea behind that was it would be a communal picnic in the suburbs.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. And then people flocked to the internet because the mall became unwieldy and just not that much fun anymore. And now people are spending all of their time in their homes on the internet, ordering clothes and food online. And now they want to get out of the house and be with people again. And the only game in town is the mall.
That's insane to think, right? What about the park?
Sometimes it's a question of what park. And this is really the thing that I think I was really salty about, about Alexandra Lang's book and some of her interviews that made me really salty. Mm-hmm. She would say things like, look, people are nostalgic for this idea of a suburb with a main street and a town center, and those aren't coming back. And she's right, and also wrong in the sense that most of these post-war suburbs didn't have town centers to begin with. They just had shopping malls.
Interesting. I can think of some bedroom communities where I'm from that, for those of you watching the show from the Bay Area or listening that'll be later listening to the show from the Bay Area, I think of Brentwood when Patrick says that. Brentwood and to some degree Concord, California definitely reminds me of that. Kind of the whole East County of the East Bay to me reminds me of just giant malls, places that are just kind of houses and then a mall. And now, of course, you know, the strip mall and maybe a school, but that's it. There's nowhere to walk.
No. I am nostalgic about the mall because I went there a lot as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I went there a lot as a teenager because there was nowhere else to go. I lived in a big residential division with no sidewalks. It was too hilly to bicycle anywhere. And of course, there were no bike lanes, and no one past the age of 12 biked anyway for whatever reason. And I was thinking to myself the other day, like, if it was a Friday night, I'm 14 years old, I want to put on my coat and walk somewhere. Mm-hmm. Where do I go? I can walk 45 minutes to a 24-hour Exxon station.
Okay.
Or a diner. And this would be along a street with no sidewalk where.
And you guys had a ton of diners where you're from too.
Yeah, the diner was more of a thing you could do if you had a car. Like that was a mall alternative for people who had a bunch of friends, were up late, and smoked cigarettes.
I appreciate the diners in Jersey. The last tour I was on with my band Bitter Lake, our drummer is from the East Coast, and by the time we got to Jersey, His California accent was gone, and he just had his East Coast accent. Corned beef and hash was ordered for the next week as we were in the East Coast. It's thank God for your guys' diners. I love them.
But yeah, like if you were 14 years old, weren't doing extracurricular activities because, you know, if in my case, you were miserable in school and didn't want to spend any more time there than you absolutely had to. There was really nothing to do but have your parents drop you off at the mall and leave you there for a few hours. If you wanted to be around people your age in a place where you could walk around and just have unstructured socialization, it was the mall. That was the only thing you could do.
Well, look, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. His article is called Malls, Fordism, and Socialism. Wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there are definitely links in the description to the Sublation article. Are you writing anything else for Sublation? What are you working on now, Patrick?
I have a Substack. It's a bananapeel.substack.com, I think. It's based on something that Marshall McLuhan said about coping with technology.
Interesting. Can you email me a link to that, and I'll put that in the comments of the show so people can find you.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Thank you so much, Patrick. I hope this wasn't like pulling teeth for you.
Oh no, I'm better on the page than I am on a screen.
Well,
more comfortable, I should say.
Look, you were great. This was fun. You guys give Patrick a shout out. So we're going to go to the champagne room. There should be a link up in the Patreon for those patrons. I want to hear your guys' mall stories. This chat has been moving like crazy with people talking about malls. I want to hear your adolescent tales of what you did for fun. Now, the mall where I grew up didn't have record stores. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. We did have great public transportations. We had this thing called Bay Area Rapid Transit called BART. So as a young kid, I would take, if I had $5 that I saved from lunch money or found in the couch, I could take the train to San Francisco for $4 round trip, or to Berkeley for $1.60 round trip. I could go to record stores and cool thrift stores and all that fun stuff that you do when you don't have any money, and roam around these places. I did spend a lot of time at a mall, but I also spent a lot of time in cities because of the public transportation that we had in the Bay Area. So I wasn't as locked out as you were in suburban New Jersey.
Right. I was talking with my wife recently about moving into the Jersey suburbs, and she said something about, like, I was saying, well, it's not really workable because you can't drive. And she said something about public transportation, and I just laughed in her face. she grew up in Queens and lived in Philly after that. So she just is so accustomed to there just being a bus somewhere that she can take. Mm. And that's not really a thing once you get out into the North Jersey suburbs.
Well, you know, taking the bus in Mexico has been a bit of an adventure, but it's one that I have been enjoying because the buses here are private.
Really?
Yeah. It's a whole different thing. And I've been taking the bus to Tijuana and hanging out down there because it's kind of, I live in a very sleepy town, like a tourist place. So TJ reminds me more like downtown LA or downtown San Francisco.
I think it was an educational experience in public transit. And I guess maybe in terms of like what it could possibly be, was I lived in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands for some number of months. It's a very, very long story. But they had a bus, and it ran this circuit from like one end of like the south end of the island to the other. And like the main hub of it was the Kmart, because Kmart was still a thing there in 2015. It was actually kind of a big thing. But what they also had was they had these people who would get these pickup trucks that they would convert into open air buses, and they would take the bus route. So, you know, the bus would stop by like once, like every hour, but like every 5 minutes, there'd be someone, this pickup truck that had like bus seating would pull up. And it was, I think it was like, if you were getting off before Kmart in either direction, you give them $2. Mm-hmm. If you got off after Kmart, you give them $4. And that was how you got around the island if you didn't have a car. And I did not have a car. And it's just one of those things. I just imagine, like, would this thing be workable in the town I grew up in if it was just, there was like a stop at like the AMP, there was another stop at like the Party City or whatever. And there were just all these little buses circling the town. And I don't know. It was just a flight of fancy.
It is, again, it's different when you leave infrastructure.
Yeah.
And I live somewhere where there's not a lot of infrastructure where there should be.
That was St. Thomas.
You know, it definitely isn't pickup trucks, but it's in some questionable vans. You're inhaling some exhaust like you wouldn't believe. And, It is a similar thing where you go, I'm going to Tijuana. Like, you pay when you get out. Like, depending on how far you go. So, yeah. If you, you know, I'm in Rosarito, so if it picks you up in Rosarito, and you're like going to TJ, and it drops you off in downtown TJ. And yeah, it's one of those things. Oh, you're going to downtown TJ, it's going to be this much money, you know, 20 pesos, whatever it is. But yeah, I, it is an interesting juxtaposition of growing up on public transportation to private transportation, privately run public transportation.
Or,
they refer to it as the public transport.
In the case of my wife, I actually, when I was writing the article, I knew that she lived for a time, this was years and years ago, she moved from Philly with her then boyfriend to Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He got some tech job, and she worked as one of the restaurants at the Cherry Hill Mall. Mm-hmm. But since he left for work earlier than she did and took the car, she had to walk to work to the Cherry Hill Mall from their mid-rise apartment, and it was like a mile or so. And I sat her down, and I opened up because I didn't think they had really much in the way of sidewalks or like workable public transit there. So I opened up asked her to walk me through your commute, and we did. And she got visibly agitated as the closer you got to the mall. And then once she got to the parking lot, she got actually angry, remembering what it was like walking to work.
It's funny because in your piece, you talk about the building out of these parking spaces, right? So it's like, Victor Gros was like, make the parking spaces where people can walk.
Yeah.
They have to walk somewhere.
He couldn't get around that. This thing had, in order to like actually operate at scale, you had to have this giant, these tracts of parking surrounded by highways and major roadways. And it just, because that's what I was thinking about, and that's why I spoke to her about it, because Gruen probably imagined that if you lived in one of these planned communities around the mall, you would just be able to just like walk out of your house and waltz to it. So I wanted to see if that worked in practice, because Gruen did in fact design the Cherry Hill Mall, although didn't get to, you know, plan all the space around it. But yeah, walking to malls on foot is reportedly terrible.
There's nothing like it. There is nothing like it. If you're walking to a mall on foot, any of the ones I've been to in my 45 years of life, you're walking a few miles just through parking lots. Like, just through parking lots alone. Outdoor malls built in urban areas are a little different. That's like the new build. That's how they're building them, right? It's like, hey, you want to come live here in this new happening city next to where all the tech corridor is? And look, there's an Apple store and a freaking Borders and a Bed Bath and Beyond. Isn't this what you people want?
Excuse me.
So
I'm dying.
That's what I see in every city in America. If you're an urban city, then there's some sort of downtown. I don't care if you're Fargo, North Dakota has them. There's a downtown.
There is a mall in Fargo. I checked.
It is. I've been.
Huh. How is it?
It is a mall.
Yeah, that's the only real mall. The only mall I visited outside of like the Jersey, Philly, New York area was in Manhattan, Kansas.
Oh.
It was a mall. I mean, I was kind of impressed just by this town in the middle of Kansas that had the chutzpah to name itself Manhattan. it had a mall. It had a business that sold screen doors or like sliding doors. I wonder how they're doing.
I think the Fargo Mall is either Fargo or what's the city above Fargo? Grand Forks. Can't remember. Matt Leck would know the answer to this. Has a big statue of Roger Maris, the baseball player, because I think he's from North Dakota. But
not familiar.
Yes. So we have to have you back on for movie night, Patrick, when we watch Mallrats.
I have not seen that one in
an What age. The hell have you
no,
seen?
I have seen Mallrats, but I haven't seen it since I was 14 years old. Does it hold up?
You said it doesn't hold up.
I mean, I'm asking you. I haven't seen it since I was
14. Haven't seen it. I saw it when it came out, and that was about it. Because that was a little... 90s movies don't hit the same way as 80s movies, because I was a young parent.
Yeah.
So I didn't watch... I watched some of them, but they just didn't... I was like, oh, this is like a bad version of something I saw 10 years ago. So Mallrats didn't hit me like, you know, Valley Girl hit me.
Yeah, if you do a Mallrats movie night, I will be there, I promise.
All right. You said it. We're going to make it happen.
Okay.
Mallrats movie night.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Will it be this month? I'm not sure, because there's a bunch of movies I do need to get done for this month's movie nights. Plural movie nights. We're going to do plural movie nights this month. I promise you guys that. So, again, thank you, Patrick. Have a very good evening. Tell your wife she made the right decision with you and leaving that jerk that made her walk. It's effed up. Making her walk like that. It snows in New Jersey. Make anybody walk in the snow? Anton says, I have a truly masochistic movie viewing addiction. Maybe. But some of these movies we have to watch for movie nights. I think Mallrats would be a fun movie. I really enjoyed watching Pump Up the Volume with you guys. Patrick, if you're still there, Pump Up the Volume. I hope you've seen Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater. If you haven't seen Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater, you have to figure out how to watch it, because you can't stream it. We watched it here on TIR. That's what we're giving you guys. I kind of want to watch Death Wish 2 with you guys because of Larry Fishburne's performance. Like, just his performance alone in that movie, to me, is like well worth the watch. And there's a few other movies that I've been thinking about that we should watch. I think we should watch Andres Mom's movie. I call it Andres Mom's movie. But How to Blow Up a Pipe Bomb or Pipeline. I definitely want to watch that. I would love to watch it with Andres, but, you know, he's overseas and the times are so difficult. And he's writing another book right now, so he's really hard to reach. Man. Someone says Patrick has only seen High School Musical 1 and 2. You know we should watch, Patrick? Patrick and I were having a conversation before he came on and talked about being a goth. We should watch. Have you guys seen this movie? Repo, the Genetic Opera. Have you guys seen Repo, the Genetic Opera? I'm not seeing anything moving on the chat, so I'm assuming you guys have not seen it. But that would be a fun movie night. I don't like musicals. I hate musicals. But Repo, the Genetic Opera, is so good. And it kind of, you know, it's definitely one of those movies we can watch and we can have a great discussion about. I thought we had a great time after watching pretty much anything we watch. Sans the time we did a double feature. I'm still sorry about Life is Hot in Cracktown. Oops. That being said, let's go to the champagne room. Look, you guys got 14 minutes of complimentary bubbly. Let's go to the champagne room. I want to hear your guys' mall stories. I want to hear... Someone says, Jason, you're trying to get me to unsubscribe. Musicals were half my childhood. Look, Zach. Musicals didn't do it for me. I had to watch West Side Story in high school. And I was like, this isn't how gangs fight. I think I yelled that out in class. This isn't how gangs fight. They don't fight like this. But I still appreciate West Side Story. When you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette. But look, let's go to the champagne room and let's have a good time. I want to hear your guys' stories about malls. I want to hear your guys' adolescent stories. I want to hear your guys' suggestions for movie night. But I think Repo the Genetic Opera will be fun. On that note, on behalf of everyone in the TIR universe, we are out. This sucks.